Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of We Earth Radio, where we have conversations that make a difference. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, conscious evolution, and spiritual fulfillment. In our programs, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to We Earth Radio. This is your host, Michael Stone, and I am thrilled about my guest today. She's a local person, and her name is Diane Walters. She's got 35 years of experience in Waldorf outdoor educational programs and alternative educational programs. She's an educational strategist, curriculum artist, and solution evangelist, serving as a homeschooling consultant, keynote speaker, and professional development mentor for teachers. Her work is deeply informed by her lifelong interest in education and in life through the lens of Rudolf Steiner's educational philosophy, contemporary educators, theorists, and futurists. And she's so much more. She's an amazing potter and an amateur astronomer and a delight to be with. Diane, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
It's just a joy and an honor. And I love having a Nelson person on my show. We're all over the world, and here we are in Little Nelson on this amazing station. And now I want to talk to Diane about education. And let's start out by talking about not just in Nelson or in Canada, but the state of education, both in the West and in the world today. What are your thoughts about the state of education? You've been in the education world for most of your entire life. And of course, you went to school. So I guess almost all your entire life. So what's happening to education? What works and what doesn't work?
Well, I think that right now, education stands on a precipice of either emerging into something brand new for the world. And we have this unique opportunity to reevaluate what learning is and how to care about, how to bring out educare, which is the root word of education, is to bring out, to draw out from, not to stuff in, full of fixed dead end concepts, a reductionist theory of an old industrialized model of education, you know, which really, you know, schools started and in the turn of the industrial age. So we were churning out a level of factory model curricula. And we've been rather stuck in that, though I have to say I'm proud to think about all the independent and private schools out there who have seen that and tried to make a difference. And now our public system in British Columbia is catching up. It's looking at connections between students. It's looking at the big ideas and the and lessening up on standardized testing. So, and putting it into a smaller category. So it's like taking an old dinosaur and making it actually rear its head. And you have to ask yourself, do we need the dinosaur? So what is it that we're trying to do? We're trying to help children today live into an emergent future that we don't quite know enough about yet to know whether or not we are preparing them adequately.
I love that you use the word educare. That really speaks to me because my experience of school, other than the Waldorf school I went to in the first grade, was not only did I feel seen, heard, or cared for or nurtured in any way in school, I felt that much of school, and I know young people I talk to today feel the same way, was irrelevant to what was happening in the world.
Right. I think what we need to recognize now is that life is education. There's no fixed end to education. I just turned 59 and I'm still learning new things. And I'd hope that, you know, from the time we're born to the time we die, that we are on a trajectory of life learning, of a development of self and world in and through the collaboration with others. So how do we create an education today that is working at a model of learning and mentorship and apprenticeship to all of our interests and curiosities? And how do we act as midwives and stewards of consciousness rather than this old fixed idea that a teacher is to impart knowledge rather than wisdom?
Yeah.
I'm
so in alignment with what you say. When I think about what would be an ideal education, it would start with inner knowing, inner science, not test tube science, not, you know, all these other things, but how do I feel? How does my body want to move? What happens in my body? How do I connect with other people in an authentic way? What is it that keeps me from connecting with people authentically? And do you feel that there's a movement in that direction of a more humanistic and more connected and connecting educational system?
Well, yes, Michael, I think that there's, as I mentioned before, quite a few private and Waldorf school and independent schools that are working on that premise, as well as a growing, very quickly growing homeschool movement that the current last 2 years with COVID has brought about.
So yeah, talk about why. Why you think that's happening. I think there's pretty obvious reasons. And the impact of that, because on the one hand, it creates closer relationships at family. It can be made more relevant to the home and the family and life like that. But on the other, there's the socializing aspect of people coming together in a community of peers, age peers, and connecting in a way to learn how to be socially in the world and communicate.
I think the value for in-person, in-house schooling can't be overstated, actually. I was just talking and mentoring a teacher from the Mohawk Immersion School south of Toronto this morning, and she mentioned that they're in school for the first time all year this week. So they have students who have been in an online learning environment finally back in their homeschool premises, and they're all so happy to be there and to be with one another again. So that can't be understated. I think that by really looking at what the last 2 years have brought us, we're at a dividing point. On one hand, we've got school systems trying to put what previous learning online, which becomes computational learning. Children have had to learn children and teachers have had to learn with how to learn and work from a hybridized model, primarily online. And that's been really tough. And it's been people have been doing the best they can with it. But it's become like taking dead fixed concepts and putting those dead fixed concepts online for children to receive on their own with all on their own with independent resources at their disposal. But they're really not being inspired to really learn from an inspired place where they make meaning out of what they're learning. So it becomes computational. Whereas that's the computerized aspect. And so what that does is it brings up the need to be more curious and more interested because there's only so much of computational learning that one can take in a healthy kind of way. And so that comes to that inner connection you were talking about. Yeah. What is that? That's our curiosity. And so how do we teach and work and learn from a place of curiosity?
Yeah. You know, COVID is not the only epidemic. One of the other epidemics that's going on is nature deficit disorder. And most schools, and as you say, there are many that are actually aware of this and some really great schools that are arising. But for the most part, nature is not part of our education and puts us as not part of it, nature, which is an interesting predicament given what the serious issues are around climate change and our complete dissociation from the natural world.
Well, it's very interesting you would bring that out, because I think that there's not only an ecological situation that needs to be addressed globally, but an eco-educational aspect that needs to be addressed, so that we're divorcing our subjects from the whole and putting them into the parts, so that we're only learning social sciences, we're only learning aspects of the humanities and language and history, and we're only, and only one type of history at a time, and we're only learning mathematics or physics or chemistry or geography or geology, and we're divorcing that and learning about it because we're specializing in it, whether it be a unit block of 1 month, a main lesson block of 3 weeks, what have you. We've divorced it from everything else. And so I had a dream about 10 years ago, after I finished a graduate degree, about a seven-pointed star I now call the curriculum seal. I'd love to tell you about
it. Yes, please.
So it's where the subject goes in the middle, and of the center of the seven-pointed star. So give me a subject, any subject, Michael, anything.
Philosophy.
Oh, philosophy. Okay, so I'm teaching philosophy. Philosophy is in the center of the circle. And now I have what I call the curriculum seal. So what is the language of philosophy?
Was that a question? Or you...
It's a question. You can go into there. Every subject has its own language.
Yeah.
As a ceramicist, as a potter, I can say there's a language that other potters know when I'm talking about a bisque fire or a cone or a level. And you might have no idea, but I know, and every other potter would know what I'm talking about, as is in philosophy. Mm-hmm. Or any other subject put into the center. And so we're working that modality. And now you could say, what is the science of philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the science of philosophy? Well, we've got a wide variety of philosophers of many centuries and globally in many, many countries. And is there a formula that has been followed? Kant had a formula that he refuted on his deathbed, but then it goes through Schiller and Hegel and, you know, a wide variety of Eastern and Western mystics and philosophers. And so you can say, where does the formula line up? Well, that formula is often a science. What is about experimentation? That's science. It should be, anyway.
Yeah.
Let's experiment and innovate and then learn from. And then you could say, what is the history and culture of philosophy? Again, go around the world and find out what the history and the culture of philosophy is. Mm-hmm. And where, so in a way, that's dealing with the past. What philosophical treatises are we continuing to live with? Out of, I'll go into the Greeks that I know of Plato, Socrates, sort of Greek philosophers who still influence our university system today.
Yeah.
Philosophy 101.
Right? Socratic method, yeah.
Socratic method, exactly. And so now we can go around that little circle and we say, what is the art of philosophy? Mm-hmm. Is there an art to that?
Dialogue.
Wow, perfect. I think, again, back to the Greeks, when philosophy, you know, different aspects of rhetoric and philosophy was in different corners of Athens, and they had kind of like our coffee houses today or our pubs, different areas, and people would talk about different things in different corners of the city. And they would stand on the steps and orate, right? The law, you know, the aspects of oration. So that's the art is dialogue and how we relay that.
It's the only way we can learn is to have some other than what we already know in order to spark something that hasn't been born yet.
Exactly, which is why working out of, you know, the curriculum seal, which is a wheel of the web of life, really, in taking a one subject, putting it in the center and taking it for a spin through art, science, math. What is the mathematics behind philosophy?
Hmm. Well, logic is certainly a mathematical structure used in philosophy, absolutely.
Interesting. Yes. Yeah. And then I started thinking, well, what else belongs there? And I realized that one of the other learning modalities that is often really understood by athletes and gym teachers, but not as understood as a mode and practice of learning in its own right. Unless, of course, you're a first grader that doesn't know how to sit in, still in their desk, but is movement, the law, the act of movement, learning through movement. Mm-hmm. Of course, most movement specialists, from yoga teachers to Feldenkrais practitioners to, you know, all of the movement specialists that we have, know that we actually, the body learns when we move. And so how do we learn? Where is the philosophy of movement and how do we practice that? Mm-hmm. And again, we would practice that through all the different movement modalities. That is a philosophy of movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's becoming more and more realized that I think in Waldorf schools, we had eurythmy in the very beginning, but the whole idea of movement is energy. Philosophy is looking for what allows us to connect energetically and to live a authentic and value-based life, I would think. And that's all movement. I mean, we're moving. We're always moving. Everything is moving. If it's not moving, it's a flat line, and that's called dead.
Exactly. Exactly. Movement carries memory also. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was mentoring a Mohawk teacher this morning, a different one, but he was describing how he was working with one of his students who had forgotten, because it's Mohawk immersion, she had forgotten the second half of the words. And so what he did is he didn't say anything. He just asked her to stand up and put her hands out. And then she remembered what it was because of how she was standing into a T, and then she knew that it was a T that she was missing. She was that it started with a T, and mm-hmm. she went back to her desk all without words.
Beautiful.
But she went back to her desk to wow. finish that, all because she just put herself into that that form of movement that reminded her of what it was. Mm-hmm. So then I was started thinking, you know, so if movement, math, art, science, language. Are part of this, what else could be another modality? And I realize that's where KCR, Kootenai Co-op Radio, really comes in, because it's the art of working on a social collaborative level. Mm-hmm. It's the art of that level of diversity. So the many voices make the collective whole, the wisdom of the collective whole. And so how do we learn anything without including other people? How do we learn? You know, we could say we do that, but I call that rather dead as well, because I don't believe that anything I know has come directly from me and only by me. And I don't believe I can patent an idea either. I think those ideas have been standing on the shoulders and in the footsteps of great people who have gifted me with those inspirations and ideas in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so how do we collect everything together into a social learning modality where the philosophy needs, what's a philosophy if not for sharing on a social level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? It requires people, or it's sitting all by itself in a dusty shelf in a dead, empty room.
So community, education, let's just deepen that a little more as we're looking at where we're headed. You know, it's easy to look at all the things that are coming down the pike, like climate change, like racism, like income inequality. There's so many huge issues, like corrupt politics, that are happening in the world. And it's really easy to just throw our arms up in the air and say, it's just hopeless. What can I do, the small person? You know, I feel strongly that community is the currency of the future. And I mean that both electrically and financially and in every way. Talk about how you see the emerging future and the impact it might have on education.
Well, I call my consulting business Teaching into the Future, Michael. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, anyone can find me through Teaching Into the Future. And but what I mean by that is, and what I've tried to do here is really relate not only the level of diversity needed for education today, but a value system that goes into the integral whole, a level of teaching out of holism. So looking at an emergent future is to really look at what is needed into something that we aren't quite sure of yet. Mm-hmm. It's like looking into what needs to emerge out of us as human beings to take care of the earth and one another, mm-hmm. and how we kind of strayed off the path with that industrial model, not only in an educational industrial model, but an industrial model that has raped and pillaged the earth herself and the non-human creatures in it. And so by looking at that level of diversity is to look at the all the languages that we need to learn. We need to learn plant language and animal language and stone mineral language, and we need to learn to relate it differently, much like the indigenous peoples worldwide did. But not to just look at that as something in the past, rather romantically or hypothetically, but to, I think, really work with our own practice of deep connection with nature. You mentioned nature deficit earlier on, which has a real problem now with the technological age, which I see, you know, dividing humanity towards the technological and those that really want to deeply connect with the earth. Yeah, so how do we hybridize? How do we do both? How do we walk into a future of technology? We're not going to get rid of that. Robots are here and increasing. Bionic eyes are coming. We have to recognize that there is a cyber future in store if we allow transhumanism to dominate the worldview. And there are political parties, transhumanist political parties, that are quite active on that. Canada herself is one of the leading players towards transhumanism. So we have to look at that level of machine and human and to say, what is it to be truly human? What is it? So we have to ask ourselves that question, I think, before we can get into anywhere with what the future needs and how we as humans can direct and develop ourselves so that we're finding out that we're, maybe to be human isn't to wreck the planet. Maybe to be human isn't to get greedy and to dominate. Maybe to be human is to arrive finally at what we perhaps knew all along, our deep connection to all the sentient creatures on the earth, mm-hmm. and to celebrate the grace of that.
That's beautiful. I love that. And two things come up in that for me to maybe chat about, two things that are missing. One of the things I feel very fortunate was I very early on learned how to manipulate systems. I grew up in the military, so I learned about how to manipulate the particular system in which I lived, and then studied systems thinking. And most people don't have a lot of capacity for thinking as a system. And I think that's really important. The fact that, you know, I have this pen here that is made of plastic that was, you know, came out of things from the earth that was shipped from China to here. All the things that went out of that eventually were air, water, fire, all the elements. And it's going to end up in a landfill. So I think the ability to think more deeply about a system. Where does our food come from? It doesn't come from the grocery store. It comes from the earth. What does it take to get it from the earth to the grocery store? So systems thinking is one issue I'd like to look at. And just to mark it, the other one that comes up for me is a lack of stillness in order to integrate and to be open to the emergent future.
You know, if you're going into systems thinking and carbon footprint of everything. You have to look to the Waldorf educational system, which always works from finding it to finishing it. So the children are growing their own food and then developing it and actually growing, developing their soil with worm farms in the classroom and composting, and then planting their seeds and then eating them and making stone soup for the whole school, if not for themselves and their parents. They're sowing the grains and harvesting the grain and making the bread after grinding it and et cetera. So finding it to finishing it is a core root model of Waldorf education.
That might be where I got it, actually, because I only did the first grade, but maybe I got it there. I don't know.
Well, the first grade is highly imaginative. And I think the role of your second question, which is based in the still point, finding your still point. And again, bringing us back to what I started with, the center and the periphery between self and world. And in a way, how do you know more? How can you know more about the world? You look into yourself and you actually find your own still point. As a potter, I need to do that. I need to be able to take a whirring mass of clay on the wheel and calm it. And I do that with an art of and act of tension, of strength and gentleness, which in varying movements, like an expansion and contraction, I'm bringing hardcore strength, but in a controlled way, into a soft gentleness. And I'm fluctuating between the two. And every potter knows what I'm talking about. But I realized lately when I did a collaboration with a violinist who happened to be one of my students many years ago, but she's now a violinist. We did a backyard concert. And she also talks about the tension in the music and while playing the violin and how it goes from tension to softness. But doing something really big requires getting stiller and stiller and finding your quiet place. And doing something, so you, in a way, in order to do something really great, you have to find that center of quiet. And I think that in educational systems, we really have to look at how we bring the children back into the center rather than always into the periphery of the learning. So in a way, I always look at how greedy human beings have been and why do we want so much? And you know, Leonard Cohen sings a song about that. So, little plug for Leonard. And anyway, the aspect of our capitalistic society really looks at how much we can bring from the world to ourselves. And it rather than how do we go into the world? How do we work from that center? What do we give rather than what do we get? And in agriculture, you could say the same thing. What do we give to the soil rather than what do we take from the soil? So that give and take comes from a deep educational system, which is centered on a breathing between expansion and contraction, between a balance and a breathing between a receiving and giving.
That's brilliant. If you just tuned in, we're talking to Diane Walter. She's a educational consultant and strategist, curriculum artist, and just an amazing potter. Actually, I would love for you to talk a little bit. I remember years ago, one of the books that had the most impact on me at the time I read it, I was just beginning as a meditator in the 70s, and it was called Centering by M.C. Richards, who it turns out was your teacher and you were her last apprentice. Can you talk a little bit about your experience of that and what you learned and how that applies to your educational work?
Oh, I think she sits on my shoulder and it completely applies. Everything she said and did applies to my educational work. M.C. Richards wrote a book, Centering in Pottery, Poetry, and the Person, in 1962, the year I was born. And it was, it's still selling hot on the shelves, as her trustee, Julie Connor, told me about. So what she, and she was, she thought education was at the core of all societal change. So to that effect, she wrote another book in her 70s called Towards Wholeness. Mm-hmm. And that was all about teaching. And she was also actually wrote a short little pamphlet called Education in the Public School and Education of the Whole Person. So she was always talking about holism and wholeheartedness and a willingness to enter radical unknowingness, to embrace dynamic possibilities, and to cultivate the hope in inspiring greater interest and understanding of the world. And she said, that is the province of a teacher. So this is a tall order. And I worked with her for 6 years as her last apprentice, and I was as a potter, but I realized I was there as her, as she was my friend, my mentor, and my guide. And so much of what she said became the subject of my graduate thesis, which I did in 2008-09 out of New York. And it was called The Unfinished Lesson, Leaving Room for the Students. So you'll find aspects of that on my blog and my podcasts I call Integral Teaching. And those podcasts are on just about every platform if you Google it. But Teaching Into the Future, the unfinished lesson is at the core of everything I believe in, which is to work, what have you said earlier, emergent thinking. Mm-hmm. How do we meet the future? Well, Yuval Harari, who wrote The 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, in the last chapter of that, he devoted to education. And I always consider the last chapter like a summing up of everything that is said. And though he was a bit of a materialist and a bit of a fatalist for humanity, he doesn't have a lot of hope for humanity, but at least not in that book. And on his YouTube, see, he did say that the three things that are needed in education today are to cultivate a sense of flexibility, collaboration, and creativity. Those are the qualities that we need to be educating. Flexibility, collaboration, and creativity. And so that if we have those qualities, if children have those qualities, they will be able to meet whatever comes down the pike from the future. And so my question as an artist and as an amateur astronomer, scientist, and as a potter, as a teacher, is to say, okay, so how do I work with imagination in the classroom? How do I work with, I work with a lot of homeschooling parents, and I'm about to start a homeschooling workshop this summer through on the island through the West Coast Institute, but it's all online. And you can find more information about that on either my Facebook or Instagram pages, all at Teaching Into the Future. Just make the plug for that. So there are a lot of homeschooling parents in our area. And really, really working with imagination is absolutely essential. Because we learn through images. And the business world has taken that up by just working with the word branding. What's branding if not active imagination? But how do we make imagination alive and emergent? And how do we put it into absolutely every subject? And a lot of Waldorf teachers know exactly how to do that. But now my task is, how do I bring that to the world? A Waldorf teacher for 25 years, and a high school teacher for another 10, so 35. And I would say, how do we work with imagination? How do we inspire? And how do we get inspired from? So it's no longer this idea of teacher serving student, but it's this idea of collaboration where it's like a Mobius strip, this lemniscate of connection between teacher and student that goes into listening and receiving. Speaking and listening, speaking and listening, so that there becomes a mutual dialogue of learning. And then at the core of it is intuition. And how do we work at the unknown? How do we work with the emergent? How do we trust the mystery of the unknown? And let what I call, spirit or grace enter into us. Through what we're saying and doing. How do we trust that? And how do we let and teach our students and our children to trust that?
Yeah, that's beautiful, really beautiful. You know, one of my concerns, as I know, is about this sea of trauma that we're swimming in. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about trauma-informed education, because it is at the heart of our separation, of our habitual patterns, our addictions, many of the things that our children are struggling with in school, as well as adults are struggling with. What are your thoughts about creating trauma-informed education, both in homeschooling and in the schools?
Well, there's only one word for that, Michael. It's just called love.
Yeah, I think you're going to
say it's just called love. And so we have to look at the principles of what warmth is in our practice. What's light and warmth? The two modalities that are essential for human connection. And how do we bring the light of clarity, the light of wisdom, the light of sun and moon? How do we go all the way out to the cosmos and back? But without sounding like too far out, really bringing light is to bring inspired wisdom. Bringing light is to bring imagination and new pictures, a pictorial consciousness to the students. Because yes, we're all suffering. Now we can really go global. I think that what you're speaking to from your own life background and deep practice in this world with healing trauma would be to recognize that everyone comes to school or everyone comes with a story. And how to create a warm connection is at the core of any kind of education, because unless children trust you, children and youth trust you, you're not going anywhere with them.
Yeah.
You can't teach them anything. You can only teach at them. You can't teach to them. You can't teach with them. You can't teach them. You can only teach at. And that's not retained. That becomes dead education. Catabolic education. So that's the warm connection. That's love and a loving warmth. If in the classroom when I had a child who was inappropriate with another child, like just bullying, really, or a very highly distracted child who sabotaged my lessons. And of course, this happened almost every day in some case or another. But what I learned to do in a community that I lived in prior to coming to Nelson, called the Camp Hill Community Movement, which is to work with special needs, children and adults. But what I learned from that and from them is to recognize that that child was only acting out a behavior. It wasn't them. Mm-hmm. And we make the mistake to think that child is a bully. That child is mean. That child is hyperactive. That child, instead of saying, hey, this is the behavior, not the person. And that behavior can be changed. And you do that with loving warmth and connection. And you can only do that when they trust you. So how do you cultivate trust?
That's so important. And you create trust by creating safety. That's kind of the first line, I think, of having trust is, how do I make it safe? Have children that come and they have attachment issues where they don't feel safe anywhere. How can we make classrooms safe? It's not just the bullying, it's the working with the feeling. And, I remember a teacher, because I had, as you mentioned, a lot of trauma myself. Hated school after my first year going to Waldorf and then going to a public school and being tied in a chair in front of everybody. And I really, truly hated it. And I think it was about seventh grade that I had an English teacher. I was just always acting out, always trying to take the power, basically a brat. So he said, when we started, I want you to write a paper on anything you want to write about. Doesn't matter what it is. Just write about something that you want to write about. So I wrote a paper on why all English teachers should be deported to England. and just really all these things I said about teachers and how messed up they were. And so I get, and then I tore the corner, you know, folded it over and handed it in. It was sloppy, misspelled words. It was just, and I got this paper back expecting an F or a D or something, you know, and all it said on it in big red letters was very creative. And I went, you know, I didn't get him triggered like I was trying, but you know, what is this? And that guy won me over to the point where my love of poetry came from that. Not only did he have me reading poetry in the seventh grade, he had me writing it by the end of the seventh grade. The difference that one teacher can make in a person's life, that changed my whole life.
Yeah, I thank God for that teacher. You know,
Mr. Quackenbush, I still remember him.
Well, Michael, I think that that is a fabulous story. And it's so interesting to know that many students, including myself, have that one teacher out of a sea of others that we didn't have, that took interest and brought light and brought warmth and brought us inspiration. And so that web, that net of safety, that you mentioned, I think is created through a level of creating and developing resilience. As someone who now mentors and evaluates and teachers and parents to homeschool or school their classes and their schools, I have been shocked at the amount of children dealing with anxiety. And this is pre-COVID. And the clinical anxiety in third grade. A lot of children are pulled out of schools because of their level of anxiety. You have to ask yourself, well, I think if I were their age, I'd be full of anxiety too. Look at our world. It's not a safe world. And there's a lot of being thrown out there to our sensory impressions that are not protective for the young child. So you have to look at this. I developed a series of workshops on anxiety and how to overcome that through resilience. And what is resilience? But the window of trauma, the psychological window of trauma, where you have your two poles, your hysteric pole and your depressive pole, which is cold and warm, which is one pole brings you down into yourself and causes you to hide away from the world, and the other pole goes into a hysteric anger. And so what you want to do is create that window of tolerance where the lifeline sort of stays in there with all the things that you love, all the things that give you safety. So whether it be a family pet, or for many students that I taught in high school, I always opened up with what is their safe place? What do they consider their sanctuary? And what are the things that they love to do? So that I knew what their window of tolerance held. And for many of them was their bedroom. It was their safe place. Rarely did they tell me it was a TV show or a video game. But sometimes that happened for older adolescents.
In psychology, we call that resourcing. That's creating time in nature or art or dancing or something that you can turn to when something is too much, which is what stress is.
Yes. If
something is too much for my capacity to hold it. So in order to expand my capacity, I have to find ways to resource myself. And if I can't do it myself, then a teacher would be someone that, if I can't self-regulate, then a teacher can co-regulate with me and help me to find those places, the happy place or the resources that can allow us to ground and create more inner capacity to hold the amount of energy and movement that's coming through us.
Yes. And that brings us right back down to the wheel of life and diversity and the need for diverse approaches. So art, to me, is at the core of diverse approaches and within itself as an aspect of resiliency, whether it be music or painting, visual arts or three-dimensional arts or crafts, woodworking, leather making, what have you, anything making, basket making, anything to do with their hands. It gets us out of our heads, which is often where the trauma, and our bodies, but it moves things through. So definitely the arts and also movement. I know for many years I was a runner, and I, at the end of every day, I think I'd be a different person if I hadn't put on those running shoes and gone for a run after school or after school in high school and after work. That is so movement and art and nature. And I think the art of actually belonging is one of Maslow's five hierarchical needs of the human being, and to recognize how we cultivate belonging so that we're never really that alone, even if we're an introvert. Mm-hmm. We know that we belong. We belong to the greater good. We belong to the greater good of humanity, and that we see humanity as the greater good rather than the greater enemy.
Yes.
So of something to fear.
One of the ways that people look at education, and it's really rampant on the internet these days, which we're going to run out of time, but I'd like to talk about that too, is this idea that something is broken that needs to be fixed in me. That I often in my classes and talks talk about our essential goodness, returning to the essential goodness. That, you know, in early childhood development, particularly in insecure attachment styles, people, when something happens and to a young person, very young person, say 2 or 3 years old, and they have a trauma or an experience of having to push something down, they say something is wrong, but they can't make their caregiver wrong because that's their caregiver, their life source. So it's something is wrong, but it's something is wrong with me. And that grows into, you know, all these different neuroses that we have that I need to be fixed. But what about education that comes from there's nothing broken, that actually you have a very intelligent nervous system that protected you at that time? Unfortunately, some of us are 50 years old and our nervous system is still trying to protect us from when we were 3. But you know what I'm saying? As a teacher, to be aware of that and aware of that fundamental early shaping in the early attachment styles, particularly insecure styles. Your thoughts about that from a teacher's perspective?
I think to look at that question, Michael, you have to look at how the whole human being and the idea that we're not just walking heads that need to be taught things, but we're walking hearts and we're walking quite literally with our limbs and how we show up in the world. And that the way to move forward is to recognize there is far more to human intelligence than just what goes on in the brain, but what is that heart center place and how to teach to that heart. Mm-hmm. How to teach to that heart is, again, through the arts. Many of the arts really allow for a new form of communication for that young child who is has experienced a level of separation or trauma and needs to heal from it and can find an avenue through another mode of expression.
And many people have been damaged through the arts. You don't, the houses aren't round and they aren't purple. You can't sing. You should try something else. You know, those messages that get laid that people are still working with, saying, I don't sing. Sorry. I don't dance.
Right. Well, I run an art studio, community art studio, where I teach adult ceramics, Earth Studios in Nelson. And I have to tell you that, you know, 9 out of 10 people that come have a story similar to that, where they said, well, I did it in high school or fourth grade. And I always believed I wasn't artistic, but I have never forgotten what it felt like to work with clay. So I'd like to try it again. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would have to say, after a 7-week class, find themselves on the opposite end of that story. And what I love the most is they come back to pick up their work when it's been glazed and fired and sitting on the shelf, and they go, oh, I did that. This might be a 49-year-old nurse, or this might be a 27-year-old computer graphic designer, or this might be a grandmother of seven. And they are just like, as kids, they're right back into that kid place of themselves. Mm-hmm. And rediscovering what the arts can do and can be, because they were shut down by an adult in their vicinity, whether it be, you know, I was 15 and banging away on my guitar out in Edmonton, Alberta, singing my heart out. And my mother said, come on in before the neighbors hear you.
You're right.
And I was like, my whole heart was in my music.
So thank you so much, Diane, for being on the show. Diane Walters, amazing. Tell them your website again, please.
It's teachingintothefuture.com, or you can find me on Instagram or Facebook under the same name, Teaching Into the Future. And my podcast, which you'll find on Spotify, Apple, Google Play. I think I'm on about five different podcast platforms, and it's called Integral Teaching. So all you homeschoolers out there, I'm doing a workshop this summer online through the West Coast Institute, and I do a lot of homeschooling consultations. So I look forward to hearing from some of you, I hope.
Awesome. Thank you, Diane. Thank you all for listening to We Earth Radio on Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thank you for your support.
Thank
Bye
you,
for
Michael.
Now.
Thank you, Michael.
We Earth Radio is an independently produced program supported by listeners like you. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, conscious evolution, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or listen to any of our past shows, go to our website, welloflight.com. Thank you so much for your commitment to a world that works for all life.